This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with former LSU Chancellor Jim Morton. He ran the Baton Rouge campus from 1981 to 1988. He has some thoughts about the TOPS program and the attack on TOPS as to whether it's a budget buster and a viable tool as far as higher education, and much more with Jim Morton about the state of affairs at the old war school. Liz Lerman, the choreographer and founder of the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange, national figure renowned, who'll be in Baton Rouge tomorrow for commencement ceremonies. She is on her way from the airport, so we will visit with her if everything goes according to form. And we'll also have a bit of a discussion about the budget situation in Baton Rouge and in Washington. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633. And if you're dialing outside the Baton Rouge area, it's 877-217-5757. Toll free. You may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Yesterday, a Senate panel rejected a $3.5 billion funding request for public schools. The Senate Education Committee approved a resolution without objection that asked the State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education to submit a new request in light of the Supreme Court ruling, a 6-1 decision that holds that the state cannot use the Minimum Foundation Program, the key source of the funding for public schools, to finance vouchers for some students to attend private and parochial schools. That sent Governor Bobby Jindal to the steps of the Capitol to make his plea that the voucher program that he is an advocate of should be restored and continued.
I promise you I will stand with you. We're going to do everything we can to make sure this program is here for years and years to come. This is one of the most important things we have done since I've had the honor of serving you as your governor.
Now, the governor has to find a way to fund vouchers for 8,000 students. $41 million estimated that it will cost, and of course, the budget is in disarray. Although there was some good news for the governor and for lawmakers, they got an extra $155 million yesterday on the state spending plan. This is because of the actions from the Revenue Estimating Conference. So the governor is steadfast in his support of vouchers, and he is steadfast in his opposition to new taxes. So we shall see what happens in the next few days at the Capitol. The session has to end on June 6th, so we are 21 days, as we know, 3 weeks away from the close of the 2013 regular session. In Washington, throughout the day and yesterday, President Obama has been trying to put the best face on a bad story for him and his government. The IRS singling out conservative groups for scrutiny and, according to USA Today, giving a pass to some liberal groups when it comes to their taxes. Now, this is something the president says he will not stand for, and he has taken action. He fired the acting commissioner of the IRS, Stephen Miller, accepting his resignation, but let's face it, the guy was told to leave. And the president is trying to come back from this, and it will be something that will likely have legs, and it may impact his appeal with voters and the population at large. Now, the president also faces another embarrassing revelation that the government was essentially spying on the Associated Press, something that I think liberals and conservatives and everybody else is not happy about. But let's face it, since 9/11, under the Patriot Act, everyday citizens have been spied upon for over a decade now, and now that the Associated Press is the culprit, there's new concern about it. But another story that's not so good for President Obama. One story that has not been given the attention it probably deserves is the budget situation, and this is to President Obama's credit. The Congressional Budget Office, it's a nonpartisan group, estimates that the deficit for the fiscal year, which ends on September 30th, will fall to $642 billion a year this year. That's 4% of the nation's national economic output. and about $200 billion lower than the estimate from the agency just 3 months ago. And this comes after a $1.1 trillion deficit a year ago. So this is about a $500 billion decrease, half a trillion dollars, and the president has gotten very little credit for this. He got a lot of criticism during the campaign last year for an economy that was not so good, but this is the largest budget deficit drop in the history of the United States. And mind you, his predecessor, George Bush, orchestrated the biggest deficit increases in the history of the United States. The stock market is up to 15,000 now and above. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, it's almost double of what it was when the president took over. So his economic performance is beginning to look much better. And there are those who now say that this president is doing a good job with the economy. Of course, there are critics, as we know, and there are others, including Alan Simpson, the Republican former senator from Wyoming, who headed a bipartisan budget panel, along with Erskine Bowles and others, which attempted to give the president and Congress a blueprint on how to reduce the deficit. I think it was yesterday we tried to play a cut and we misfired with Alan Simpson. So here's what he said a few months ago regarding the budget situation.
It doesn't matter what you call it. You can call it Obamacare or Elvis Presley care. I don't care care. It can't possibly work. Now, really, this is the serious business.
No,
and all you have to do is use your beam.
All right. That's Alan Simpson saying that the health care plan, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Plan, would be a budget buster. Well, according to this, and this is the Great Congressional Budget Office, the deficit will go down to $642 billion this year, a half a trillion decrease from a year before. So if Obamacare is breaking the budget, the actual numbers show a much different story. And, of course, the president will never get any kind of plaudits from some people who have been his critics from the day he took office and before he took the oath of office on January 20th, 2009. One of those is Rush Limbaugh, who has commented frequently over the last few years about the high unemployment rate. And by the way, unemployment is now down to a level lower than it was when the president took office. He has actually lowered unemployment in his 5 years in office, almost 5 years. Here's Rush Hudson Limbaugh.
The labor force participation rate grew by over 500,000 people in 1 month. Those are jobs that have vanished. Every one of those people is eating, and pretty much what they want to eat. And every one of them has a cell phone, and every one of them has no trouble getting around. And they all live somewhere. And so to them, you say, well, it's not working. Well, it is for me. I don't have a job, and I'm doing well.
Well, for all the talk about class warfare and the president being accused of it, and before him, President Clinton, because they advocated taxes on the wealthy, Mr. Limbaugh sounds a bit like he's engaging in some class warfare. And there is now this sentiment that the haves are in one camp and the have-nots are in another, and the have-nots outnumber the haves. So therefore, President Obama, because of a numbers game, is president today. That's why some believe he got 52% of the votes. But the story, of course, is much more layered and complex than that. And the president seems to have done a job with the economy that has been beneficial to everybody, including people of means. When the budget deficit goes down and when unemployment goes down, it's a benefit for the entire country. But like Bill Clinton before him, President Obama will never get credit from the far right, people like Mr. Limbaugh, who still has 15 million listeners to his show every week and packs a wallop with some sectors of the United States electorate. But Mr. Limbaugh has been on the air since 1988, and since then, if you look, he just went on in 88, so we can't give him any credit or blame for the 1988 election, but in 1992, Bill Clinton won. 1996, Bill Clinton won. 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote. 2004, George Bush won a very narrow popular vote victory over John Kerry, and an even more narrow electoral vote victory. And in 2008 and in 2012, President Obama won. And so with Mr. Limbaugh being as popular as he is and spawning a legion of imitators on the dial, in the last six presidential elections, Democrats have received more votes than Republicans five of those six times. So there could be an argument made that Mr. Limbaugh and his imitators are actually good for Democratic presidential candidates. At the same time, though, the Congress has become largely Republican, at least on the House side, and the districts are such that it will be difficult for Democrats to change the tide. Even though Democrats got more votes than Republicans in the U.S. House races nationwide in 2012, the margin showed 226 Republicans winning and 209 Democrats. So the districts are drawn in such ways that it makes it extremely difficult for the Democrats to regain control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Next year in Louisiana, the showcase will be the U.S. Senate race, and there will be national attention for this, and it looks like the battle lines are drawn. It'll be Republican Bill Cassidy, the man who represents the 6th Congressional District right here in Baton Rouge, who 10 years ago was a Democrat who supported Kathleen Blanco for governor. He will be on one side, and Mary Landrieu will be on the other side, seeking her fourth term in the U.S. Senate, and it should be another close race. Mary Landrieu is one who is always in close races, having won in 1996 by 5,766 votes over Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins. 6 years later, she beat Susie Terrell with about 51% of the votes, and then in the last election in 2008, she defeated John Kennedy, with Kennedy getting a little over 47% of the votes. And as a result, Mary Landrieu won a third term. 18 years in Congress when she runs for re-election next year. She has now served as long as John Brough did when her term is completed. And if she gets a fourth term, she will be among the longest-serving U.S. senators in Louisiana history, but still has a long ways to go to catch Russell Long and Bennett Johnston and Alan Ellender. And Bennett Johnston, by the way, served 24 years, so if Mary Landrieu were to win next year, she would be have the same number of terms that Senator Johnston did from 1973 to 1997. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined in studio by the man who ran Louisiana State University from 1981 to 1988, and has been on campus for
89,
early 89, though, right? Jim Wharton is with us, a fine gentleman. And how many years teaching at LSU?
Well, I racked up 50 years all total.
In the chemistry department?
In the chemistry department, professor of chemistry.
And I'm told you were quite a professor. Did you teach when you were chancellor?
I taught the whole time I was a dean, and I taught while I was chancellor at Alexandria. I didn't teach in the 8 years that I was chancellor of the university.
As we've noted a few times, and we're going to get a few things with Dr. Wharton, but when he was chancellor, these were some of the most interesting times as far as the athletic program. Wild success on the field and an occasional controversy off the field. And the one steady hand amid all this was Larry Jones, who was twice the interim athletic director. And I understand Larry is literally fighting for his life. He's had a tough battle with esophageal cancer over the last year.
Yes, that's true. We're all, those of us that work with Larry, are very concerned about losing him, and it's clear now that we are going to lose Larry.
79 years old, and he was recently named the Alumnus of the Year and was a recent guest on this program, and he is quite a gentleman, and during the last 25 years or so, he's raised $35 million for LSU. So he certainly has done great work for his alma mater.
Yes, his persistence in fundraising has been remarkable. The only person that's raised more money than Larry did was Ed Steimel over in engineering.
They used to have a competition. Well, we'll talk about money and higher education and the TOPS program and the new president at LSU and all kinds of matters with Jim Wharton when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Dr. Jim Wharton is with us. He was chancellor at LSU for 8 years, and he has been a part of the fabric of life at LSU for a half century. And I did get a note here from Lauren online about another fallen tiger, Oscar Richard, the public relations director for many years during your tenure as chancellor. And he was quite a man.
Yes, we all loved Oscar. He was one of the most dedicated people I've ever known to LSU, and he was also very loyal to his employees. He really took care of his employees.
He was really a gentleman and lived a great life, 91 years, but he was a POW, and we talked about him last week, an amazing man, and we were privileged to have him as a friend and as a part of LSU. Now, just about the whole student body at LSU right now is on the TOPS plan because of the admission standards. And if you're from Louisiana, if you can get into LSU, you can get TOPS, right?
That's pretty much the truth, yes.
So there are those who are saying this is not such a good deal, that about 44% of the TOPS recipients don't make the voyage to graduation. 56% lost their scholarship during the first year in college. That was a report in The Advocate last week. At LSU, is that the case?
No, that's not the case. And what you just said is an impression that many legislators and others have about TOPS. Actually, it's 44% that lose their TOPS award, and they call that canceling the award. Now, just because they lose the award doesn't mean they drop out of college. They go on in high numbers and graduate. The secret about TOPS is that working to get the award, they get prepared for college and they do graduate. That same audit report that generated the 44% that lose TOPS said that 69% of all of the TOPS students graduate. Now, that's the six-year graduation thing.
Six-year.
Yeah.
And at LSU, it's higher than that, isn't it?
No, I'm going to explain some things about graduation rates later if the questions
sure.
go in that direction.
Well,
but LSU has a National Center for Educational Statistics graduation rate of 62% for all of its entering students. And there are a lot of students that enter that don't have TOPS. Athletes would be an example.
Well, and out-of-state students.
And out-of-state students. It's 62% at LSU. That's by far the highest in the state. But that doesn't take into consideration all that happens to LSU students. And let me just go on into that right now. There is an organization called the National Center for Educational Statistics. And there's a clearinghouse. And Louisiana doesn't use that clearinghouse. Recently, the registrar at LSU and I, his name is Robert Dulles.
About to retire.
About to retire, yeah. You know a lot about the university. Robert and I decided to look at what happens to all the students. And the clearinghouse started just checking on students that had debt. But then they realized that so many students have debt that we just as well keep records on every student. And Robert and I took 2004 up till today, looking at what was happening to LSU students, freshmen that entered the university, top students. And it turns out that 70% of them graduate from LSU. 30% transfer out. Now, I shouldn't say that. 15% transfer out for sure. And they graduate at all over the nation. A large portion go to New Orleans to finish in medical fields. That's not MDs, that's undergraduate degrees. Some go to Southeastern for the nursing program and so forth. So it's an 85% actually graduate somewhere of the top students. And the Board of Regents and the legislative auditors, they don't use that national clearinghouse to track down what happens to every student. It's a partial audit. It's not a complete audit.
297-5633, we'll talk more about higher education, more than the TOPS program. But The story that circulated last week indicates that students who met the lowest eligibility requirement for TOPS were the most likely to have their award canceled. And I don't want to dizzy our audience with statistics, but the report showed that 44% lost their awards, and of that 44%, 56% lost in the first year. But most of those were at the lower end of the threshold. Should we raise the bar a bit? Would that help?
No, it wouldn't help that much. The advantage of TOPS is that Louisiana has been an open admissions state, and the admission standards to most universities are not very high. So TOPS sort of forms an admissions criteria for universities and causes the students to work harder in high school. We're raising the standards right now. I spent the last 4 months looking at high school curricula, the courses, the syllabi, advanced placement courses, international baccalaureate courses, and dual enrollment courses. Mm-hmm. And passing through the legislature right now is a bill, Senate Bill 202, that will get rid of what I call the Mickey Mouse courses that are in the TOPS curriculum and put in, for the most part, rigorous courses. And there's something that takes place with TOPS. People want to help the kids get TOPS. And so they put pressure on the state to put in courses that are not high standards, they're not rigorous, and they don't realize that they're not helping the student, because once they get to college, especially if they borrow money and they don't have the right preparation, they're going to be unsuccessful.
Well, the TOPS program, which is the Taylor Opportunity Program for Students, it began in 98, so it's been around 15 years, pays tuition and some fees for students. And you have to have a minimum 2.5 grade point average and a 20 on the ACT to be eligible. Now, those are not real high accomplishments. You could be in middle of the pack in high school and meet those probably. Why not raise it a bit higher than that?
Well, you've got a situation with the public schools in Louisiana, the small rural high schools. Have difficulty even with the standards now. I remember in 84 when LSU put the admission requirements in, which I led that fight. I thought Governor McKiffin was going to kill me. But
I remember.
the reaction on the part of principals and superintendents across the state was simply that our parents are happy, they're content, the students are content. Why do they have to take all this algebra when they can take an arithmetic course and make an A or a B? And the admission requirements to LSU were not to satisfy students' high school career, but rather to make sure they could be successful at LSU. And right now, LSU's requirements are considerably above the TOPS requirement. It's a 3.0 grade point average and a 22 ACT.
So, yeah, if you're a Louisiana student, unless you've got some special dispensation, if you're an athlete or some other person who has a talent that is beneficial for admission to LSU, you're going to be eligible for TOPS if you're a Louisiana person. Now, the tuition has risen, and part of that is a TOPS phenomenon, because if the state is paying the freight for these students, then ultimately there's a cost to doing that. And tuition's risen by $330 million since 2008, and it's going to go up some more. Is there a level where it becomes too expensive for many people in one of the poorest states in America to send their kids to college?
Well, it's already there. Let me explain something about the cost of an education. It's not just the tuition that you look at. How long does it take to get the degree? And I'll just use one university, Chapel Hill, 77% of all the students graduate in 4 years at LSU.
In North Carolina.
At LSU, 31% graduate in 4 years. And so the time to degree is much longer in Louisiana. LSU has the shortest time to degree. Several years ago, it was a little bit less than 5 years, but more than half of the student body took at least 9 semesters to get a degree. And when you start adding on that additional cost, there's more than tuition involved in the cost of getting a higher education certificate or credential.
But we still have one of the lowest rates of college graduates in America.
Yes, we're right at the very bottom of the nation. That's something that really puzzles and worries me, because enrollment has been held as a higher goal than performance and quality of education for many years in Louisiana. And people brag about we've got 18,000 students. And some people will tell you we have to have the enrollment because we need the money. But these students borrow money. I've testified in a number of federal courts where I say that for an institution that's bringing kids in that they know can't graduate or won't graduate and encouraging them to borrow money, that the president of the university ought to co-sign the loan. And I would say that's true. Now, there are a couple of schools in Louisiana that have come up in graduation rates. Louisiana Tech and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette have both increased. They're nearly 50%. There are a number of things. Parents looking for a college for their child should be really educated with regard to how to choose a college. They should look at graduation rates. They should look at time to degree, and they should look at what fraction of the student body graduates, what the fraction of the undergraduate student body that graduates each year. And, for example, 18.5% of LSU's undergraduate student body graduates each year. That may be a little closer to 19 by now, but at Chapel Hill it's 24% graduate. And that's true for a lot of universities.
What is that? Is that, Chancellor, is that because the students are better at Chapel Hill, or maybe LSU is a little more challenging than people realize?
Well, LSU fights a battle. This is a little known fact, but the Board of Regents lists for LSU a space utilization factor of 0.91, I believe. Now, what that means is that LSU is about 35,000 square feet short on classroom space. And that's the equivalent of 60, 40 student classrooms. And kids can't get their schedule at LSU. It's just flat out that. And that has an impact on the graduation rate, and it has an impact on the time to degree for the university. LSU uses a waiting list. Back in the days of Chancellor Merle and my time as chancellor, we got a management report that told us how many kids were trying to get into English at 10:30 or math at 9:30, and we would direct the departments to add sections. Now they have the waiting list, and the kids just don't get the class. It's just that simple, and that's especially true for laboratory classes, that they can't get their classes. LSU is the only institution in Louisiana that has a shortage of space.
Okay. 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Kobe writes, I was born in Scott, Louisiana, spent the first 11 years of my life in Louisiana, moved to Alabama, then decided to come to LSU after high school. I know many who have done this. What can we do with TOPS or as a state to help encourage more Louisiana students to come back home for their higher education?
Well, there was a bill in the legislature this time that could have been a good bill. It was by Representative Green. It got killed, I think, yesterday in committee. But it would have said that if a student left Louisiana to go to college and got a college degree in another state, at no expense to the state of Louisiana, they could come back and use their TOPS award at the graduate level. And Louisiana high schools desperately need teachers in the STEM fields, the science, the technology, the engineering, and math. And we're really short of qualified teachers in those fields. So if people came back and got a master's of natural science, let's say, in one of those fields, that would be a big boon to Louisiana's secondary education system.
It's a university that incites great passion. Jim Wharton's an example. You actually did your undergraduate work at Northeast Louisiana University.
That's correct.
Right?
That's right? correct, yes.
And then came here and a couple of degrees afterward?
I came here for my PhD. The story there is that I would not have gone to college. My father was in the automobile business and the huge drought in that time period in Oklahoma. And all of a sudden one day, two football coaches showed up at the grocery store where I was working and just came in and offered me a football scholarship at Northeast. And so I wound up in Monroe. And I had there are three teachers up there that I'm told, I never did see it, but I was told that I made a perfect score on the graduate record exam, and I won a National Academy of Science fellowship, and the military gave me 3 years. And LSU and Berkeley were the only two schools that would say you could get a PhD from a baccalaureate in 3 years, and that's how I wound up at LSU.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Chancellor Jim Wharton. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Is LSU adversely affected as a flagship university because too many legislators are more focused on promoting their, you know, regional universities?
That's a very good question. When you look at the statistics that have to do with efficiency of universities, Louisiana has four times as many chancellors and presidents per 10,000 students as does the state of Florida. Now, there are a lot of states that have as many teaching locations, but they don't put in full-blown institutions. Ohio State, for example, has six teaching locations in the state of Ohio, and there's just one institution. All the faculty, all the students, all the degree programs, medicine, whatever, all part of Ohio State University. And that's much more efficient than breaking into pieces and having what we call backstore functions like business and personnel and all of the different functions of a university. And so, yes, a local payroll is really important. And if you get out into Louisiana and you visit Thibodaux or Lake Charles or wherever, you find that payroll is very important, and the Chamber of Commerce is going to argue strongly to have a full-blown university in their community. This idea that higher education is a driver of economy is true, but it takes about 20 years for a PhD research project to result in anything worthwhile. And you're just not going to have that from a small regional school.
We'll return with Chancellor Jim Wharton. It's been 24 years and counting since he was running the university, but he's been around, he still is, and he's here to talk about higher education, something he knows a bit about. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jim Wharton is the guest, the former chancellor at LSU. 297-5633 is your number. Question from Ed Richards, who, of course, is a professor of law at LSU. He says, the problem of getting courses to graduate is endemic Louisiana schools. My daughter's master's degree at UNO will take at least 2 years longer than it should because of the failure to offer required courses in the necessary sequence. Many of the students in the program give up without graduating. Is that a pervasive problem?
It's certainly one at LSU. I can't speak to UNO. Of course, UNO went through the terrible trauma of the hurricane. And I would guess that they've had trouble coming back with their full schedule of classes since that hurricane.
Well, another question from a listener from Lee. He asks, should the boards of higher education be consolidated?
Well, let me answer that. If you went to the Louisiana legislature and listened with all of the different presidents and chancellors inside the legislature, the Board of Regents staff there, you can see real quick that there's not a single plan for higher education. On the other hand, when you go into states that have a single board, and I made it a point to take the LSU board to Chapel Hill and to meet Bill Friday, that famous president up there. I put Chapel Hill on the football schedule so that I could get them all up there. But you see real quick that there's one voice inside the legislature with regard to higher education plan. And there are as many voices as there are institutions, and their local chamber of commerce is all support whatever that institution's trying to do. And there are a lot of people who have opinions about what should be done that don't know very much about higher education.
Mm-hmm. So when LSU played North Carolina in 1985 and Bill Arnsparger led the Tigers on the field at Chapel Hill, that was because of a clandestine scheme by Chancellor Jim Wharton.
That's exactly right. There was one other time that I insisted, and I didn't even want a return game. I insisted that we play USC because I wanted Lod Cook to see about 150 Tiger fans in his suite on top of the Larco building in Los Angeles. And that paid big dividends for the university.
He contributed a few dollars along the way. That's another question. To be chancellor, you were an academician, but you essentially had to become a politician, didn't you?
Well, you had to come up with good management plans. There's no question about that, and they had to be logical. And you had to recognize the ultimate authority of the governor and the legislature. That's not true in Louisiana today. There are people who think that they ought to have as much say-so as of their operation as the governor and the legislature. I did spend a lot of time, but I spent a lot of time on a number of things. For example, CAMD is one of my biggest disappointments. I spent 3 years getting CAMD for LSU, and that's a disaster.
Why has it not worked?
Because it got moved off the campus. There was a idea that we'll move it out there and start a research park out on Jefferson Highway. That was one of the biggest reasons I stepped down as chancellor. I lost control of a three-year project that I'd worked on. But another project that I was able to get through was the big gravity wave experiment in Livingston Parish. That's after I left the chancellor's office. I worked several years on that, flying to Caltech to talk to the physicists out there, going to Washington and talking to people there. And then there were three final spots for that. One was in South Carolina, and the other one was in Maine. And I convinced the researchers that Maine was too cold and South Carolina had too much plutonium contamination in the Savannah River. The only thing we had bad about Livingston Parish was that we had to buy a strip of land 75 feet wide and 2 kilometers long, and then at right angles to that, mm-hmm. one 150 feet wide and 2 kilometers long. And that was hard to do.
Now, when you were selected as chancellor in 1981, in fact, if I remember right, chancellor, your first graduation class in the summer of 81 was my graduation class. Gus Weil was a commencement speaker. But chances are, if there had been some headhunting firm out there getting people from all over the country, that you might not have been chosen. And it turned out okay. Some said it turned out real well with you as chancellor. Are we doing it the right way? Is this progress to get a headhunting firm to come up with people like F. King Alexander and Mark Emmert?
Well, I have my own personal opinion about headhunting firms. I call them, and I talked with one of our great employees, Caruth McGehee, yesterday, and Caruth reminded me of a concept, and we call it traveling CVs.
Have CV, will travel, yeah, right?
And I was contacted by headhunting firms on a number of occasions.
To be a candidate at other places,
To be a candidate at other places, but I had my mindset that I was going to get LSU to a Research One status, a Carnegie Research One.
You were barely 40 years old when you became chancellor.
Right. And there was, it was wide open public applications. I'll tell you, the best applicant for the job wasn't me. I was second best. The best applicant was the guy from Arizona. I think his name was Mulholland. He was awfully strong and awfully good. But he demanded things that the board couldn't go along with, that he wanted them to stop the search and choose him and pay the salary and so forth. And the board didn't go along with that. And I really believe that the board went to the second best candidate.
If I may ask, what was your starting pay as chancellor?
64th. Dr. Merrill, when Dr. Merrill retired, I guess he retired in 70, and the position wasn't filled until 71, but he was making 64.
In 80, you mean? Dr. Paul Merrill?
Yeah, 80. I'm sorry. He was making 64. And
64,000.
64,000.
To be chancellor of LSU.
Yeah,
well,
that's true.
And you made about the same?
I started at the same salary that he left at.
Well, the new guy's making $600,000 a year. The
highest salary I ever made was $94,000 after 8 years, and that involved a housing allowance.
$94,000 after 8 years. Are we doing a good thing, or does it really matter if people tend to get what they can, and F. King Alexander got a nice compensation package. He's still considerably behind the basketball coach, the football coach, the baseball coach at LSU. But is $600,000 a good figure for the president and chancellor of LSU?
Well, I if you compare those salaries to the private sector, there's not as much at risk, and I think they're inflated and too high. But of course, I never did make that kind of money.
Well, Mark Emmert drove up prices all over the country, didn't he, when he was chancellor here at little old LSU?
That's true. Governor Foster agreed that his salary should be increased dramatically. And also the football coach drove up that.
Of course, that football coach named Nick Saban, who at that time was a 49-year-old journeyman.
Yeah.
And then Emmert hires him at $1.2 million a year, doubled his salary to get him from Michigan State.
I thought it was 1.8. But anyway, yeah, you're right. And that just caused a change all over the nation. But I will say this. Of all the people that we've had in and out of LSU, Mark Emmert was one of the most talented and able people that we've had. He and I became good friends. He asked me to do a number of things for the university after I'd left the chancellor's office, which I agreed to do. I spent the last 12 years rebuilding the university lab school, both academic program and the facilities. We've done about $30 million over there
it's
in construction.
Beautiful school.
Yeah.
297-5633. Still time to talk to Chancellor Jim Wharton. Paul Anopoulosis. Paul, you're on the air with Dr. Wharton.
How you doing, Dr. Wharton? How you doing, Jim?
Fine, thank you.
Dr. Wharton, if you had to redesign the higher education system for Louisiana, would you increase, decrease, or leave the same the amount of four-year universities and two-year universities right now in the state? I guess I'm basically asking, do we have too many? Can we afford it? Can we stay at this level? Or should we decrease? Thank you.
Well, let me say this, that there are going to be changes in higher education in the next 15 years that are going to be dramatic because states are realizing that they can't afford the high cost of higher education and they have to do something. North Carolina, there were a year ago 73 high schools that could offer up to 60 hours of college-level general education. And so North Carolina is moving enrollment out of universities and down into the high schools. Their legislature in Ohio, they deal directly with the institutions. They don't appoint all of these committees in between. They just tell them what to do. Ohio has directed that all the four-year institutions in Ohio must have 60% of their degree programs completable in 3 years, which means that the students got to show up with at least a year of college-level work already completed.
Mm-hmm.
There are big changes afoot. If I looked at Louisiana, I would say that, and this would never happen because of politics, but institutions need to be merged. In this electronic age, there is no reason that you've got to have separate institutions. You need the teaching locations because that is important in the financial picture for students, to have an institution close by. But the need for a whole full-blown institution is not there. And I'll just give an example, which will get me in trouble, I'm sure, but Louisiana Tech could manage ULM, Grambling, and LSU Shreveport from one location.
You think that would be good? And that includes your alma mater, by the way.
Yeah, it includes my alma mater. Yeah, that would be a much more economical thing for the state of Louisiana.
What is the biggest challenge that LSU faces?
The biggest challenge is recombining all the pieces. When General Middleton was president, and by the way, I love that man. I got to know him just a little bit when I was starting out at LSU. His only fault was he didn't support graduate education that much. He thought LSU was an undergraduate military-type operation, but still, he was a person of great honor. Getting to the issue for LSU, I guess it was the late 50s, early 60s, that they began to have the medical school in Shreveport, the teaching location in New Orleans, the teaching location in Alexandria, the teaching location in Eunice. And LSU sent out deans to those locations. It wasn't very long until the chairman of the board wanted his son-in-law to be a chancellor at UNO, and so they made UNO a separate institution in New Orleans. And the medical school separate, the Ag Center breaks off, the Law Center breaks off. And so LSU, when they use the word flagship, it's really not a flagship. It's a bunch of pieces of a flagship. And that hurts LSU. If you add up all the research funding for a school like Ohio State, it's getting close to $800 million. LSU is way down in the $200 million category. And here's the reason. The federal government says that if an entity is headed by a chancellor that reports to a president, then that's a separate institution, and the statistics are kept on it separately. LSU's graduation rate on the old main campus goes up automatically if you bring in the New Orleans Medical School and all of its medical programs down there, the allied health fields and so forth. So the thing that needs to be done for LSU, and I feel sorry for this poor guy coming in here from California. He's never been in a university that had experiments like the gravity wave experiment in Livingston Parish. And there's an awful lot of LSU that conflicts with speeches that he's given, but that's not the reason I feel so sorry for him. He's dealing with all these pieces and different points of view, and he's dealing with major financial problems.
Major financial problems because the budget at the state capitol, which turns 81 years old today, by the way, there's an aversion to funding higher education through taxes. Do you think that's an unfortunate approach, or is that something that is palatable?
Well, the question of how you fund higher education in this country is it's really a difficult question. Most people don't realize if we take a private university like Rice, that Rice will have a tuition that's $40,000, and in the minds of most people, the parents and students are going to pay that $40,000. But the truth of the matter is that about the only people that pay $40,000 at Rice are non-resident aliens from China. And Rice just has an endowment that they step in and pick up the cost. And there are a lot of schools that are much higher tuition than a school like LSU, but if you look at the net price, and you can get this, there's a web page called the College Navigator, ncees.ed.gov/College Navigator, and all 3,000-plus institutions in the United States are in there, and you can see the graduation rate, you can see the net price, you can see the tuition, you can see everything about the bloody institution. And So the way you fund it, LSU needs to raise a whole lot more private money, just a whole lot more. That's going to be a difficult chore in Louisiana because it's still true that people think of state support providing the needs for LSU.
Well, Chancellor Wharton, it's always a pleasure. Let's do it again soon. Unfortunately, Liz Lerman was unable to make it here, arriving a little bit late at the airport, but we'll try for her again as well. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time. Jay Darden, the Lieutenant Governor, graduate of LSU, will be with us. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.